Hello, I'm Preston Schlankofer. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disasters might affect you and your community. This week, we're talking to Dr. Joe Alton, a medical doctor and preparedness expert. But before we talk to Dr. Joe, I must warn you that we are still in the cold and flu season, and it's imperative to fortify your immune system to counter these threats. What I recommend is doTERRA's On Guard protective products, specifically their beadlets and soft gels. The On Guard ingredients of pure essential oils make this one powerful aid in helping our family maintain good health. You can too. Visit our website at oilsforlifetoday.com. That's oils, number four, lifetoday.com. Or just go to the link at the bottom of the show notes. That'll take you straight there. So let's get on with our show. Dr. Joe Alton is an actively licensed medical doctor and a fellow of both the American College of Surgeons and the American College of OBGYN. He is the New York Times best-selling author of the book Excellence Award winner, The Survival Medicine Handbook, plus the number one Amazon bestseller, Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease, The Layman's Guide, and others. Dr. Alton is also a contributor to magazines like American Survival Guide, Survivor's Edge, and others. And welcome to the show, Dr. Joe. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Preston.
Hey, this is a pleasure. I have to admit, American Survival Guide is one of my two go-to magazines that I must read. Matter of fact, I subscribe to that and Grid Down, Off Grid by another outlet.
I've written for them too.
Oh, okay, great. I'm familiar with some of your articles. I'm familiar with some of your books and things like that. Although I must admit, I don't have a copy of the Survival Medicine Handbook, but that's going to be one that we're going to be getting just to round out our medical supply information. So I know there's a lot of things that in the preparedness community and civil defense that are health related. What brought you to this position where, as a medical doctor, you feel it's imperative that you get the word out on being prepared medically?
Well, I guess my personal experience with it all started with Hurricane Katrina, where we had a major disaster, and a lot of people think that we dropped the ball with regards to our medical response to it. But we actually had hundreds of medical personnel converging on the area even before the storm was completely over. And so that wasn't the problem. There was all this equipment, all these people that were trained and willing to help, but they couldn't get to a lot of folks that were injured and sick simply because of the flooding. So that it just sort of hit me that, gosh, there are some times when you're not going to have the ability to access modern medicine. And so it only makes sense to be medically prepared yourself. And so my mission became to put a medically prepared person in every family. And I think that's just important. So medical preparedness, that is the ability of a population to deal with sickness and injuries in tough times. The old prepper adage, but beans and bullets, should also add bandages to it too. So it's beans, bullets, and bandages. I'm the bandages guy.
All right.
So it's gathering food, having clean water. These things are very important, and food preparation is very important too. And the medic in a mutual assistance group in these kinds of settings has to be in charge of a lot of things to protect their people, including things like disinfection of water. I think in the early part of any true knock you off the grid for a long period of time emergency, well, I think you're going to lose a lot of people simply because the water is contaminated. You're going to have a lot of diseases that will cause dehydration due to severe diarrhea. For example, cholera would be one of those. And we used to lose millions of people back before we had intravenous hydration, things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And we're not going to have that in any situation where things are bad and you can't access modern medicine. You're not going to have a bunch of IV sets and cases of liter bottles of IV fluid. So it's very clear to me that there are going to be some deaths that could be avoided if people had some medical supplies in their medical storage. And I'm not talking about just band-aids and Bactine spray or things like that. I'm talking about things that would deal with bleeding, things like tourniquets, things like blood clotting bandages and dressings, pressure dressings, splints for orthopedic injuries, antibiotics for infectious disease. I'm probably mostly known for being the first doctor to write about the use of fish antibiotics and bird antibiotics in survival settings. And indeed, there are a few of them that I have proven that are identical to the antibiotics that are used in regular doctor's offices and dispensed by pharmacies.
Yeah. Now, in a survival situation, no matter what it is, if it's a total grid down or just a Hurricane Katrina type of situation where medical emergencies are not answered because of the situation, having the ability to take care of things like sprains and broken bones and puncture wounds from nails or whatever is a very important aspect of being able to take care of yourself until that help arrives, if it's going to at all, right?
You're absolutely right. In the mindset in which I write and do videos in and do podcasts in is that something has happened that you can't access modern medicine in any way, maybe for the long haul, and that you are now the end of the line when it comes to your family's medical well-being. So that's the thing, is that it's not just being able to set a broken bone. It's not just being able to stop bleeding or to clean an open wound and then wait for the ambulance, because the truth of the matter is that the ambulance may be heading in the other direction, or the ambulance may not exist if enough casualties occur. The medical infrastructure is going to be overwhelmed. And so it's important to know not only how to deal with it from a first aid standpoint. You can get, there are many excellent classes and books on first aid and CERT classes and first responder classes. Those are awesome and you certainly should take those. But in this situation, you are responsible for the care of that patient from beginning to end. And they're either going to recover or they're not going to recover because of the knowledge that you've accumulated and the supplies as well. So this is something that I've written about in plain English for pretty much everybody. And my website, doomandbloom.net, has now over 1,200 articles, podcasts, and videos on various aspects of medical preparedness, everything from infectious disease to trauma to ballistic trauma to pretty much anything that you can imagine, you'll find there.
Yes. Now that kind of brings us around to another subject I wanted to bring up, because you know we've got this 2019 coronavirus. It's not looking like it's going to be taken care of anytime soon, and it has a possibility of spreading even more so than it has. And so if it does turn into a pandemic, this type of situation would cause a lot of people to stay at home or stay very close to home, which means that if something should happen at home, then the ability to take care of it through the information that you've just talked about and provide in your website and your books and your medical grab and go bags, that stuff becomes even more important, because you may not want to venture out into the community to, you know, that you may be exposed to something.
You're absolutely right. You know, in outbreaks of infectious disease, social distancing is not just for people that are germaphobes. I mean, it is a standard recommendation. It's actually recommended by the U.S. government that you socially distance yourself from places where there are crowds and stay about 6 feet away from people, even on the street, if you're on the street. And so you're going to see a lot of people bugging in, and they're going to be left to their own devices. Now, if you look at the coronavirus epidemic in China, and they've changed the name of it, now it's called COVID-19, COVID-19. 19. It just stands for coronavirus infectious disease 19. And there's a city called Wuhan where it all started. And there, it is the seventh, I think, largest city in China. It has 11 million people in it. But if you walk down its streets, it's pretty much a ghost town. And that's because people are hiding in their homes. And if they are sick, they want to actually stay there because they know that about 80% of people will get a mild form of the disease and will actually recover on their own. And so they're hoping that if these people that are sick there are hoping that indeed they're going to be part of the 80%. And the people that are presenting to the hospitals there are the ones that actually can't breathe. If you can't breathe, you obviously need some kind of respiratory support.
Right.
So all these people, there are 11,000 or 12,000 people that are in, quote, critical condition there, that they've actually been able to identify. And of course, I'm not sure I believe the Chinese government statistics, but just think about, just, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, truthfully, Chinese communists, do they tell truth?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's more for them about saving face than fixing the problem.
Oh, yeah.
And so, well, you know, so the stuff that you hear from them is basically that strategy for them. It's always been their strategy, and it's their strategy now. But think about your hometown and what 11,000 people needing ventilator support would do to the local hospitals there. Okay, it would absolutely stretch the medical infrastructure to the limit, and probably there are a lot of people that can't breathe, have physically bilateral pneumonia, you know, both-sided pneumonia, double pneumonia, and can't get put on a ventilator because there's just no ventilators left.
Right.
So these are the types of things that you have to do. In these cases, if an outbreak comes to your town in the U.S. one day, basically, you need to socially distance yourself. You need to have proper equipment, and you need to be able to put together a pretty decent epidemic sick room, which I write about also, where you'll find articles on that and on our website. Of course, and I have an entire book on it, and in Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease. And so for your sick room, always should be away from, as far away as possible from common areas, places where food is prepared, places where the kids are running up and down the halls. You know, they've got it. You want to have that over one side of the apartment or one side of the house. And it's very, very important to make sure that this is minimally furnished, that has good ventilation, because you don't want to accumulate a high concentration of viral particles in the air, and good light, of course, so that you can work. And you have items in there, I want it to be the absolute minimum, maybe a work surface, maybe an area to examine people, and cots or some other kind of bedding, but not fabric, a place that has carpeting, a place that has fabric furniture. That's something that's not good because the virus has a tendency to sort of stick to those. And with the coronavirus is a very unusual virus in that it can stay alive on surfaces for, gosh, up to 9 days, they say. So this is a big issue. You have to also have a lot of disinfecting materials. Household bleach is one thing that you could do. A 1-to-10 solution of chlorine would kill the viruses. So that's something that's very useful. You should always have a basin with soap and water as well. So these are just parts of what I recommend in terms of putting together a good sick room. Now, having said that, I mean, I don't want to go to your house tomorrow and see an entire sick room put together, ready to receive, you know, half of the members of your family. But you do need to think about it, and that's what preparedness is, right? It's having a plan of action. You don't want terrible things to happen. I mean, hell, I won't die at age 90 with my grandkids whispering in my ear, what are we going to do with all this medical supply? But you know, what are we going to do with all this stuff, Grandpa?
Yeah.
but you have to realize that you're not immune. Now, I'll admit to you that tomorrow, next week, maybe next month, you're not going to be involved in some terrible disaster. At least I hope you're not. But think about it over an entire lifetime. Maybe. And if you add in your children's lifetime, well, maybe the chances aren't so small that one day you might be involved in something. So it just makes sense to be prepared, have articles that will help you deal with infection, have items that will help you deal with trauma, and just realize that sometimes the truth is that ambulance is heading in the other direction, and medical infrastructure can be overwhelmed.
Yes, yes, and it can be overwhelmed very quickly because it's just not set up for large emergency situations. It's onesies, twosies kind of thing, you know, traffic accident over there, house fire there, things like that. But something like this, I mean, any medical personnel in the area that would be able to respond would be at the hospital more than likely, helping with the patient.
Let me tell you what happens in a disaster. Let's say a disaster occurs in, where do you live?
In Virginia.
In Virginia. Let's say there's a disaster that occurs in Hampton, Virginia. Well, what you're going to have is you're going to have people from Richmond. You're going to have people from Newport, from Baltimore. You're going to have all these other communities that are going to send their resources to your area, you know, right, from Norfolk and other places like that. Now, what happens, though, if we have outbreaks in all of those cities? Well, all of those resources, instead of going to help that one community, those resources are have to go inward, right, to help the people that are sick into each individual community.
Right.
And so that's what my concern is with the epidemic outbreak, is that instead of being able to count on other communities to deal with issues, with, like, for example, in China, there are like 15 cities that are on quarantine. Well, you know what? That means that these communities have to basically put themselves first. They're, you know, their citizens are the first priority. And what that means is no help is coming to these other places. That's the scenario that would scare me, I think, the most with regards to this virus, or really any infectious disease that came around and affected a lot of people.
Yes. We've had regional disasters like Katrina and Hurricane Sandy and earthquakes in California, but we haven't had a national tragedy like a pandemic or a grid down situation where there is no help coming from other communities. It's whatever you have organically in your community, that is what you have in order to meet the threat and recover from that threat. There's no exercise that I'm aware of that has any national scope on this type of scenario where there's no mutual aid coming from anywhere. You have to, you know, every little community has to survive on their own. And I think that's a problem with our emergency management system, where they don't practice a total grid down, let's, you know, just use that as a generic term, grid down type of scenario.
You're absolutely right. I've taken a number of courses online through FEMA just to see what they recommend. And basically, it's all a lot of bureaucracy, and it all functions with the assumption that there's an unlimited amount of supplies.
Yeah.
And an unlimited amount of help that's coming. That's not going to be the case if a really, really, really virulent flu or other kind of coronavirus, any kind of virus comes into town. The closest example I can give is the Spanish flu back 100 years ago.
Right.
Well, that flu, it infected about a third of the world's population, and it killed about 50 to 100 million people. That, interestingly enough, is just a 2% death rate, which is actually the exact death rate that we're seeing so far, at least that we know of, with the coronavirus.
Yeah.
And so if the coronavirus really gets out of hand, we're talking about the deaths of a lot of folks. Mm. Now, I have confidence that we're a little further along in understanding infection than we were in 1918, but still, it's going to be very difficult. I mean, think about what happens. Think about what happens in a grocery store. Okay, you pick up an orange, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you look it over. Okay, it looks like a pretty good orange. I'm going to take this. But you know what? You know that you were the only person that handled that orange. Obviously, somebody stocked it. put it in the pile with the other oranges, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the cashier. There's a conveyor belt. You put that on the conveyor belt, and the cashier touches it. And then if there's somebody bagging the groceries for you, well, they touch it too. So you've got all of these different individuals that have touched you, just the orange that you buy at the supermarket. So you have to realize that there's almost no situation where you are in a pristine environment that does not involve risk of contact with a virus, because a lot of people have touched the same stuff that you have. And then you touch your face, which is the worst thing. You touch your nose, your mouth, your eyes. You may think that's, well, I don't have to do that. Well, just look at any member of your family for 20 minutes and see how often they touch your face. You touch your face so often that if you've touched something contagious before then, it guarantee you're going to get the sickness.
Well, it's like you pick up a heavy box with both arms, and all of a sudden your nose itches. I mean,
yeah.
it's just one of those things, you know? So, yeah, it's going to happen, and it does happen quite often, as you said.
So it just makes sense for you to be very careful. Now, the thing with this coronavirus that's sort of crazy is that they seem to have they decided early on that the incubation period, the time between where the virus enters your body and the symptoms start happening, was about 14 days. But now they realize, because people seem to be coming back after having negative tests and coming back sick with coronavirus, that it's probably now 24 days. So all these folks that have been released from quarantine after being observed for 2 weeks, some of these people are coming down with the coronavirus. So it's a weird virus. It's hardy. It lives on surfaces for longer than the average virus. It has an incubation period that is very unpredictable and is probably longer than what we thought it was. It's a brand new virus, and we're just now learning about it. Interestingly enough, the coronavirus family is actually pretty common. You've heard of SARS, sudden acute respiratory syndrome, in China. You've heard of Middle East respiratory syndrome in the Middle East. And those are just the deadlier diseases. I mean, it was, I think, a 10% death rate with SARS and a 35% death rate with Middle East respiratory syndrome. But coronaviruses account for other strains of coronaviruses. There are seven total, account for 15 to 25% of all common colds. So coronaviruses are all over the place. And the problem with that is that a coronavirus is what they call an RNA virus. It doesn't have DNA in it at all. It only has RNA. And RNA viruses, you generally have really high mutation rates when they're compared to DNA viruses. And that leaves the possibility of genetic errors more frequent. Now, when I say mistakes, genetic mistakes, I mean that as it reproduces in the host cell, an imperfect copy appears. And that imperfect copy, in most cases, nothing much happens. In some cases, that actually might hinder the virus. But just as often, mutations occur that improve the ability of the virus to succeed in some way. Let's say making it multiply faster, making it harder to kill, and making it be able to infect other species.
Hmm.
And that's one of the theories that's out there. Coronaviruses, and funny thing about bats is they seem to be a reservoir for a lot of deadly viruses. That's where they think Ebola came from, and that's where they think SARS came from, and Middle East respiratory syndrome they think came from camels. That's the thing, is that they have live markets with bats, and people eat bats there in China. And when these viruses replicate, they oftentimes mutate. And that mutation, something may have happened that caused that to actually go into another animal, maybe like a middleman type of animal, like a snake or any of the other of the things they have. They have a lot of crazy exotic animals in these live markets in China.
Right.
If you want to eat a koala bear, you can actually get a koala bear. They'll slaughter it right in front of you, and they'll butcher it for you. You can have a koala bear sandwich.
Wow.
But it's true. And what happens is that they have all of these animals in close proximities, including bats. And so you wind up having this RNA passed that mutated, passed to I don't know, a koala bear or a wolf pup or whatever they might have, a snake, whatever else they might eat. And then it mutates again, goes to humans. So that's just one, by the way, that's just one theory. The other theory is that there was some kind of lab accident over there. Wuhan, China is actually the one place in the country in China that has a biosafety level 4 lab, which is the highest, the lab they use for the most contagious diseases. Mm-hmm. And it happens to be in Wuhan.
Their military bioweapons lab is right there as well, from what I've heard.
Exactly. So was there some weaponized virus that possibly could have been accidentally let out? I can't believe that they purposefully release a virus into their population. So there would have to be a lab accident if it happened. Now, I can't say I have any knowledge that this actually happened, but I have nothing to disprove it either.
Right.
But the thing is that coronaviruses do, they are in bats. Bats are sold. People eat bats in China. So that's the, at least what the conventional medical wisdom is that it came from them.
Yeah. So we've kind of beat up the coronavirus a little bit in the last couple minutes. Can you tell us, no, it was great information, Joe. It was really, really good. I'm tracking right there, and I learned a couple things here. Can you give us a little bit more information on being prepared? The some of the things, maybe some of the courses that family members should look at taking, and some of the more involved things that everybody should be doing. I know, you know, stop the bleed is a big thing around the country. We should know how to stop the bleeding. We should have basic first aid and CPR. What else should we be looking at?
Well, I think that it's important to make sure that you have a well-populated medical bag. You know, that you have a lot of stuff in your kit that can deal with the things that are going to happen. And I've taken top 10 lists from the Doctors Without Borders, who spent several months in a remote location without, you know, modern help. And they have a list of things that are most common. And I want you guys out there to have supplies that will deal with these. Of course, minor injuries are very common. So I want you to have, you know, of course, your Band-Aids and your antiseptics and things like that. There can be more serious orthopedic injuries that they found. So you want to have some of those splints. The splint should be malleable. In other words, you should be able to shape it. The SAM splint is the most popular of these. And it can do, the SAM splint is so versatile, it can make everything from a wrist or ankle cast to a neck collar. So definitely do that. You can look at our website. I want people to have different kinds of bandages. I want you to have gauze rolls. I want you to have non-sterile and sterile dressings. I want you to have something that would allow you to apply pressure to a dressing. So that would be maybe like an Israeli battle dressing. Uh-huh. Or maybe a SWAT tourniquet. And speaking of stop the bleed, we're certified stop the bleed instructors. And having more than one tourniquet, you can't have just one tourniquet. You have to have two, because sometimes one doesn't stop the bleeding. So you need to have a second one. And of course, there's always a chance that you may be in some situation where there may be more than one person injured at a time that you might come up upon. In normal times, you might come up upon a car accident. In bad times, of course, who knows how friendly your neighbors are going to be. So these are things that are important. I want other things that are common. Let's say if you were knocked off the grid, you'd probably be having to make campfires and things like that. Use fire to cook food. And you know how kids are with regards to fire. They are very curious about it. So you're going to see some burn injuries. And so you have to have, you know, some aloe. You have to have some nonstick dressings. Because, boy, those things hurt if you have used regular gauze on them.
Oh, yeah.
I think that these are some of the things that are important. And with regards to bleeding, besides the tourniquets, I want you to have hemostatic dressings. Now, these are expensive. And I'm going to admit it to you that right now that these are expensive. But they're important to have. Things like Quick Clot, Stelox, KytoSam. These are important things to have because they'll stop arterial bleeding. And that's something that, you know, along with it, that's something that's going to be very, very useful to have. And, you know, they're about $30, $40. I mean, some of these, maybe more, but it saves a life. And so, and I've seen these things in action. I mean, I'm not sure if they're still on YouTube, but before you could actually see a Selox or a quick clot demonstration. They actually take a knife and they cut open they sever the femoral artery of a pig.
Oh, wow.
Then they watch it for 90 seconds. They don't do a darn thing for 90 seconds. Then they take out the Selox or the hemostatic dressing, and they pack it in there and apply pressure for three minutes, and the bleeding stops from the femoral artery, from one of the largest arteries in your body.
Wow.
Okay. Then, and in Hampton, you're from Virginia, the guy who's the purchaser for the Navy in Hampton, Virginia, he told me about an experiment they did as well, which they actually shot with a 45. They shot the leg of a pig and did that same thing to make sure that they could stop the bleeding. It stopped the bleeding then in that pig. Then what they did is they shot the other leg.
Mm.
And then they took the first dressing out and stuck it in the second wound. And it stopped that bleeding too.
Wow, that's effective.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the kind of thing that I want you to make sure that you have. Also looking for antibiotics. I think you should, like I said, I was the first doctor to talk about fish antibiotics and things like that. There's a special that was on the History Channel. It was called After Armageddon. I don't know if you saw it. But in it, the Johnson family is caught in some super flu epidemic, kills most people that... So they're on their travels, and what happens is they meet up with the community. They could use the skills of the father because he was a paramedic, and so he becomes a medic for the community. The only problem is that you just don't sit there in your office waiting for a survival disaster injury to occur. You have to go out there and you have to, you know, weed the plants and, you know, garden. You have to do all sorts of stuff, and he was doing all sorts of stuff he wasn't used to, and he got injured. The injury started turning red and warm. It became infected.
Mm-hmm.
And so he looked at all the supplies. There were no antibiotics. And so for the next 3 weeks, he just watched it spread and spread, and went to his bloodstream, and he died.
Yeah.
And that's a high-level medical resource that was lost, and he knew exactly what would have taken care of it, but there was none of it. So I want everybody in the preparedness community to have some antibiotics. I don't sell them. Mm-hmm. Or anything like that. I feel it's unethical for me to sell those kind of things without physically putting hands upon you. But there's apparently an entire industry that will sell these things to you. I have all sorts of articles on which antibiotics I want you to buy, what their brand name is in terms of their veterinary equivalent. And it also explains why I know for a fact that these are identical to human antibiotics. There are only about a dozen or maybe a couple more than that meet my strict criteria. It has to be one ingredient only, the antibiotic itself, nothing to make scales shiny or feathers brighter.
Mm.
It has to be marketed for animals, but only produced in human dosages.
Oh, wow.
That's what first made me suspicious.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So if I want to give my guppy here a fish, an antibiotic because it's got fin rot or some other bacterial disease of fish, well, I have to give it an adult dosage of adult human dosage of fish mox. And then it has to look identical to at least one version of the human antibiotic that's made by a pharmaceutical company. And for fish mox, which is the most popular fish antibiotic that's being sold, the 500 milligram version is a red and pink capsule with the numbers and letters WC731 on it. The human version is a red and pink capsule with the numbers and letters WC731 on it. See what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And since then we have a lot of pharmacists that, you know, that follow our blog, and they have just basically confirmed that they make them all in the same batch and they just split them up, and one distributes them in bottles as say fish antibiotics and the other one distributes them as a human antibiotic.
Hmm.
But they're indeed the same thing.
Well, that sounds like another show. So in the meantime, civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. That's civildefenseradio.com. And be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_def_radio. And again, I wish to thank Dr. Joe for being on the show, and I wish to thank you, our listeners, who are with us every week. I really appreciate you being on the show with us this week. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.